All right. We're going to call the case of West Charleston Lofts versus Farina et al. And it's case number 74104. I'd ask the parties to state your name along with your counsel. And appellant, let us know how much time you're going to need. Mr. Balducci was my extern in 2010, right?
Yeah, 2010.
So I just want to put that out there. Not that that will affect me one way or another, but 8 years ago.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Caleb Mason from Brown White Osborne. I'll be arguing for
the All right.
Okay. Maybe we'll hear some more about California law.
All right. We'll hear from Mr. Balducci.
Chief Judge Silver, and may it please the court, we are requesting writ relief in this particular matter because the district court failed to apply the plain language of NRS 38.221, subsections 6 and 7. Let me first begin, if the court may allow, to provide a brief background of how we got here in the first place. 2 years ago, in October of 2016, Farina sent a pre-litigation demand to my clients. We filed an arbitration complaint. We moved to compel arbitration. In June of 2017, we were sued in California at the very same time when we had a hearing set before the 8th Judicial District Court for that motion to compel arbitration. And since that time, we've been engaging in litigation here, even after having a validly entered order compelling arbitration, and we've been subjected to litigation in California for, at this point, over a year and a half.
What happened to the what happened with the district court on the amended motion to compel arbitration on the other investors, not the Farinas? I'm just curious.
Yes, the 8th Judicial District Court, out of an abundance of caution due to the stay order, took the hearing off calendar and is waiting for this court to either reach a result or allow it to, I guess, lift the stay as that particular area to allow the district court to then hear the petition as against the other Aspen investors that are named in this particular case.
What about on the California side of the case? You know, you've mentioned
this. Have you been
this
making
conundrum.
A general appearance?
No, we are still making a special appearance in California. We were subjected to jurisdictional discovery for months. We're actually still briefing personal jurisdiction at this point over a year later. So it's been a really costly endeavor, which is why we filed for the stay before the district court in the first place. First reason being, under the plain language of the statute, it states that the court shall stay any judicial proceeding.
Well, let me ask you this. Okay, statutes aren't the supreme law of the land. Okay, above statutes you have the U.S. Constitution, the Nevada Constitution, the California Constitution. Regardless of what you think the statute says, under what provision of any constitution can a court of this state reach into California?
Well, I'll answer that question as directly responsive as I can. I think people are getting caught up on what I find to be a very firm distinction that this particular statute has. It refers to any judicial proceeding. Now, a proceeding is a case. A court is a group of judges sitting to hear and resolve and adjudicate disputes. So what I'm trying to say is a court and a case are different. Cases are personal to the parties that file them. They're in control of them. Courts, on the other hand, I would agree with you, you cannot restrain a court. However, the district court in this case, and any court for that matter, if it has personal and subject matter jurisdiction over the parties, it can enter orders against those parties, which, in like in this case, we are suggesting and believe the statute requires that the parties be stayed from proceeding. And so what I mean by that is that the parties in this case are stayed from prosecuting any judicial action, a case personal to them, against my clients, for which they've already been compelled into arbitration, and in fact we have the pending motion, which provides this court with a second reason under that statute that the stay is required. And from that point, once the order is entered by the district court, presuming this court were to instruct the district court, as we believe it must, we can then take that order, domesticated in California, under the full faith and credit clause, the California court will then decide whether it will allow that stay against those parties to be applicable. And so what I mean by that, it's not necessary to postulate as to what the California court's going to do. What we have...
Why, is it just because you didn't want to make a general appearance? That's why you didn't do a motion to stay the proceedings?
Yes, the issue there would be under the way we've interpreted California law is that if we did anything other a objection to jurisdiction or a motion to dismiss on form nonconvenience, which we've...
What if you just walked in and said, hi, I need a stay because we're litigating all of this in Nevada. And, you know, just out of just sheer reality, they have a lot of cases. And they hear that, wow, this is being litigated in Nevada. If I'm the California court, I'm thinking one less case on my docket. Why not just request the stay?
Reason being, that is a request for affirmative relief that under our interpretation in California would then basically waive our jurisdictional arguments. Any affirmative relief at all. To be quite candid with the court, I haven't even pro-hopped in that jurisdiction because of how fearful we are. I just took the California bar in July, which was a nightmare. I already know it's a failure, but it is what it is. That's why. We're being cautious, but we are not going to waive our client's jurisdictional rights in California. That's why we haven't asked for that relief. And if you actually look, we provided the court citation to this California Code Rule 3.160 or something of that nature. It tells the parties, when there's a stay entered, who's supposed to do that. And because we've specially appeared, and not generally appeared, it's the onus is actually then on the Aspen investors to do so, which they haven't done. They've taken a narrow interpretation of this court's stay order, and so what we're asking is a very clear instruction to the district court to reverse its order and to stay the Aspen investors from prosecuting their case against my clients. That being said, there's policy reasons why this should be enforced. If we have any other finding otherwise, it basically creates a playbook for how you can avoid contractual arbitration. That being, you can just go ahead in another state and file a suit, and there's no teeth. That's what 3822167 is. It's the teeth that requires a party to go to court-ordered arbitration. Because otherwise, you can just litigate your lawsuit, like what's happening here, requiring the parties to incur needless attorney fees and costs. We need to protect the Chapter 38. We need to have it enforced. We can't have parties just running around suing people other places because they just don't want to go to arbitration, even though a court, which admittedly has subject matter and personal jurisdiction, has ordered them to go. They've still never appeared in the arbitration.
Well, but you're assuming essentially that judges in the other states aren't sharp enough to figure out that's what's going on and dismiss that case. Isn't that kind of what you're assuming?
With respect to the arbitration?
Well, with respect to any action brought in another state. Essentially, you're saying that this is a way to evade arbitration, just file actions in other states. But presumably, the judges in the other states will see what's going on and dismiss them. So that's not actually an escape route.
Well, you would hope so, except that I'm in a position where if I tell the court, I want you to stay, this case, based upon California, actually has a nearly identical statute to us. Like Nevada, they've adopted the Uniform Arbitration Act. So we have a case where I can't ask that court to put a stay because I'm waiving my jurisdictional arguments. Puts me in the conundrum where if the California court believes, I'm not going to stay or dismiss this case, you're going to proceed. Well, I just waived my client's jurisdictional arguments. I mean, this is the case.
Well, if they're just going to proceed, then they're going to proceed anyway. They know that if you make that appearance, you say stay it. Nevada's got jurisdiction and this Nevada district court has said they're going to arbitration. If that California court just says, no, let's have a trial, let's tee it up for trial, then why would they ever give full faith and credit to the stay when they know, I mean, technically they know what's going on anyway. What's an order going to do from the district court? They're going to thumb their nose and say, we don't care about arbitration anyway.
Well, right now, we have an order. It hasn't been domesticated there. It says the proceedings below, which the Aspen investors have interpreted as meaning just the 8th Judicial District Court, meaning it doesn't apply to our case in California. If I have an order that tells me they're stayed, I can then go to California court. Well, actually, they would be obligated to do so under California Code of Civil Procedure 1281.4. They have to let them know. That's what we need. We need an order consistent with the statute, staying them from prosecuting this other action against my clients. If you have any further questions, I think, I still have more time. It was counting down, not up.
You were hoping.
Yeah. So with that part being said, in terms of the policy, we need to also appreciate the other policy consideration behind arbitration. It's quick, efficient.
Well, let me ask you this. Why is this dispute even ripe here? This is not a repetition. If you are correct, and there's no personal jurisdiction over you and your clients in California anyway, that case is going away. Why do you need a stay? Why don't we just wait and see what happens with the jurisdictional argument?
We have spent more than $100,000 in California, probably closer to $150,000. If the district court had entered a clear stay that we could then domesticate in California, my clients would not have incurred $150,000 in fees at a minimum in a jurisdiction where we believe we shouldn't be, particularly because we had a valid order and still have a valid order compelling them to go arbitrate in JAMS arbitration in accordance with the operative underlying documents. That's the other part of this. The policy of less expensive resolution of disputes. I'm $150,000 into fighting jurisdiction. That's a lot. I mean, when you think about it, we could have had this case done and over with. It's more than 2 years later, and we are no closer to having this case adjudicated than I was when I got Farina's October 2016 pre-litigation demand.
And you want to go to JAMS knowing that David Lee is a JAMS, right? Isn't Lee, David Lee is your guys' side. You're representing the other side, and you want...
That's what we want.
David, you just want David Lee.
We
want
to be in jail. Okay. David Lee's be nice, but I don't know. It'd be a problem.
David Lee, I was expecting to see him here, but you guys want it to go to JAMS despite David Lee being there.
Yes, that's what the contract required and the order required.
Are these identical claims in California? Are they identical? Did they walk it? I mean, because I saw fraud was one of the issues. So is fraud one of the issues here as well?
Yes. Our complaint is a claim for declaratory relief that my clients don't owe any more money to the Aspen investors. Mm-hmm. It's predicated upon all of the transactional documents and everything that went on that they are challenging and trying to unwind to get to their fraud claim. And that's what we told the California judge. Mm-hmm. Their case is a case in a case. Mm-hmm. First, they have to unwind the transaction. Mm-hmm. Second, they have to prove fraud. So at the end of the day, fraud, unfair business practices, you name it, they got to go and attack those contracts requiring arbitration. And as we know, under United States Supreme Court law and even under our Nevada law, attacks on the contract are for the arbitrator, not for the court to decide. Unless the court has any further questions for me, I'll retain my retaining time for a rebuttal.
Thank you. Sorry, we'll give him 1 minute. I had a question right at the end, so we'll give him one extra minute if he needs it in rebuttal based on my question. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Caleb Mason representing the real parties here, which is John and Tina Farina as their capacities as trustees of one trust. And I think that is an important point. I heard my colleague, Mr. Balducci, say they or them, I think at least a dozen times in the context of, well, they've already been ordered to arbitrate, we've already got an order against them. That's not true. The motion that they filed, that is the petitioners filed in the district court, that led to the order compelling arbitration was directed at only one of the then seven plaintiffs in this case. There are now 13 plaintiffs in the case. Again, they directed it at only one, the Farinas. That is the only party as to whom there is any order. So it's simply not true that they have been ordered to do anything. I think Mr. Balducci's statement of the procedural history of this case is also not accurate. I could refer the court to our answer in which we've set forth the procedural history. Perhaps the most important point is after the demand letter that we sent, the petitioners here went to simultaneously, without telling us, both federal court and state court. They went first to federal court. They served that petition to arbitrate on us. That was dismissed. We opposed it. Federal court tossed it out. They never served the state court petition on us. We had no idea that they had done that. They served it in December of 2016, didn't serve it on us until after the federal court had dismissed their petition. So we were waiting to resolve the federal court petition for arbitration before filing our lawsuit, which we did. The
idea that somehow the California lawsuit is a response to the Nevada arbitration petition is not accurate, and it is not true. I think the court is probably well aware of the general background of the sort of transactions that are involved in this case, and probably with Aspen Financial specifically. I represent now 13 investors. Most of them are elderly people or family trusts who lost a lot of money investing with Christopher Stimmer and Jeffrey Gwynn, but these were not actually investments. An investment, you put your money up, you know the risk in advance. These were loans, and they were induced to make these loans because the loans were personally guaranteed by Mr. Stimmer and his wife and their family trust in one of his companies. Our causes of action, and there are 11 of them in the California case, they do include fraud, going all the way back to the initial fraud in the inducement to make these loans on the basis of a personal guarantee that Mr. Stimmer and the other guarantors never intended to honor. What our lawsuit alleges and what we are going to prove at trial is that in 2011, in May, and this particular letter is in front of the court, it's pages 86 to 90 of our petitioner's appendix, real party's appendix, Mr. Stimmer, together with Jeffrey Gwynn, who was the head of Aspen Financial at that time, fraudulently misrepresented to the group of lenders in this loan what their options were. Rather familiar story. I was a federal prosecutor long ago. I worked a lot of frauds. Everything in this case looks very, very similar. You have people who are vulnerable, they're disaggregated, they're unable to work together or coordinate their efforts, and you tell them, you're in a pickle, you have these three options. And what they were told in that letter was, your options are, you can just continue with indefinite forbearance, you're not going to get any more payments on these loans, or you can take possession of this piece of property, which is just a bare patch of dirt, and you'll immediately owe $184,000 in back taxes, or third, you can join in this new joint venture that we're going to set up. And we think, Mr. Stimmer thinks, you're going to get all your money back and then some in 5 to 7 years. Because he's going to develop the property, he's going to team up with Howard Hughes, they're going to do all this great building on it and do a lot of great revenue. None of that happened. And we contend, and we intend to prove, that they never intended to do anything with it. The whole purpose of that communication and this transaction was simply to allow Christopher Stimmer to avoid this personal guarantee. Which is what happened. As we know, 5 years later, the property was sold at a deep loss with no attempts to develop in the interim, and my clients ended up getting only 17 cents on the dollar of their original principal. That is the transaction.
Why didn't you then appeal the motion to compel arbitration? I mean, what you're saying is, if believed, and I'm not saying, but if believed, it's a fraud. Why would you agree, or why wouldn't you appeal, or why wouldn't you have writted the decision of Judge Kephart to compel arbitration in a contract?
That is a good question, Your Honor, and there's two answers to that.
Okay.
First, there's case law from the Nevada Supreme Court. The case is called Tallman, and it's cited in my briefs, that expressly says a party may not appeal an arbitration order in an interlocutory proceeding like that. You simply cannot do it. Not only that case, there were two others. We looked at them. It looked like that was the law. We were continuing to evaluate our options as to whether or not to do that when all of a sudden we got the stay motion. Mm-hmm. We opposed the stay motion, and the district judge properly denied the stay, at which point the petitioners took an emergency writ. So the question of what we would have done ultimately mm-hmm. was taken out of our hands, because here we are. And that is why, as I argued in the answer, that is why the issue of the appropriateness of the arbitration order is properly before this court, because the petitioners decided to appeal. The basis for the stay order that they request, and I would like to talk briefly about that, because there are straightforward and I think quite easy reasons why the district court's order denying the request for stay was correct. But I think it is also appropriate for this court to ask about this statute, NRS 645B340, which gives the holder of a majority interest in an aggregated loan certain enumerated powers. The only basis for the petitioner's attempt to impose this arbitration provision on my clients is that statute. The Farinas voted against this agreement, and none of the lenders, not the 400 lenders on these loans, the 56 of them who were Californians living in California, or the 13 of them who are now plaintiffs and my clients in this lawsuit, none of them agreed to an arbitration provision. If you look at the letter that I've just alluded to, pages 86 to 90 of the real party's appendix, there's no mention of an arbitration provision. There's no mention that if you vote for this proposal, we will then impose on you an absolute waiver of your right to seek legal redress for any perceived wrongs in this transaction. We're talking about a guarantee agreement, which is an irrevocable promise to guarantee these loans. It was signed by the individual defendants in the California lawsuit, Mr. and Mrs. Stumer, their family trust, and another one of their companies. That guarantee agreement has no venue provision. It has no arbitration provision. It waives statute of limitations. It waives all other procedural defenses. And it expressly provides that it is irrevocable forever unless modified in writing by all parties, which never happened. So, in this case, I think it is fair to say, and this court is an appropriate body to do it, that NRS 645B340 simply was never intended by the legislature, nor should it be construed by a court, to give this kind of blanket, absolute, blank check authority to people like Jeffrey Gwynn and Aspen, who accumulate 50% plus one of the interest in an aggregated loan, to simply do whatever. I mean, think about it this way. If Jeffrey Gwynn had decided, what he did was he signed on behalf of, you know, all lenders, he signs onto this joint venture with its operating agreement that has the arbitration provision, which they now want to enforce. What if he had said, I've decided on behalf of all lenders, I'm going to trade your loan interests for these three magic beans, and I think they're going to grow, and we're going to have, you know, great returns on the beans, and everybody's going to get their money back. Is that an act that he could legitimately have taken? I mean, you can think of lots of causes of action that one might want to sue for in that scenario. The claim at issue before this court is that NRS 645B340 literally allows the majority holder to do anything. Now we, and I mentioned this in my papers, we looked at every single case construing that statute. There is not a single case in which any court has ever construed that statute to allow the majority holder to bind the minority to an arbitration provision. That is not within the scope, especially if you think of the adjustum generis canon, it is not within the scope of the other five enumerated acts that a majority owner is allowed to take. Those have to do with the disposal of property, and I think we all, having lived through it, remember the reasons why this sort of power can be appropriate, why the legislature enacted the statute in the first place, so that you did not have property that literally could not be disposed of, sitting there vacant for years. So, there are certain ministerial tasks, finding a mortgage agent, executing foreclosure documents, etc. Those are enumerated in the statute. Other than that, this is a limited authority for acts that require the participation of all interest holders, and creating a new LLC, signing everybody onto a joint venture agreement, and executing an operating agreement with an arbitration provision, that's not within the scope of what's reasonably constitutional.
Is that really the issue in front of us, though? Aren't we just talking about the effect of a certain statute and what we can do in California, and can we parse it as was suggested in the opening argument, say, no, you can't enjoin a court, but you can at least tell the parties that you have jurisdiction over, no, don't do this.
Yes, Your Honor, and I would like to turn to that. And the reason that I addressed the 645B statute is in part to respond to the policy suggestions that Mr. Balducci was making. I actually think the policy analysis cuts the other way. But because they appealed, so this issue is now in front of the court, the arbitration order was wrong, and therefore any putative request for a stay premised upon it is wrong. But let me turn to the specific, I guess, two easiest reasons why the request for a stay is wrong. First of all, it was filed in the wrong court. The language of NRS 38221, and this is subsection 5, if there is a judicial proceeding, then any request for a stay must be filed in, quote, that court. Right? At the time...
I think what he's trying to do here is he's trying to get around that by saying he's not asking us to stay the proceeding. He's asking us to order that the parties who do reside in Nevada, and at least we, you know, based on what I can see, I don't have any reason to doubt that we have jurisdiction over them. That's a separate issue, but assuming we do, he's saying we just want you to order that they stop participating in the California litigation, presumably under penalty of contempt. So he's not actually saying we want a stay of the proceedings. He just wants some order personally to these people that you can't go to California and participate.
I appreciate that distinction, Your Honor. The distinction the court is making is between a stay and an anti-suit injunction. What the court is referring to is an anti-suit injunction. And in fact, in the district court below, the petitioners made two motions, two separate motions. One of them was for a stay under 38221. The second one was for exactly what you've described, an anti-suit injunction. These were two motions asking for two different kinds of relief. The second motion was also denied. District court denied it, and the petitioners did not appeal that denial. So the request for an anti-suit injunction, that is an order directly applying to a party before the court, ordering that party to refrain from litigation, not before this court, because the petitioners did not appeal it. So the only thing, and you can see this, it's on page 2 of the petitioner's brief, issue presented, did the court err by not applying NRS 38221, which is the request for a stay? They are not the same thing. Petitioners did not treat them as the same thing before the district court. They were two separate requests for an order. They were two orders. Now, the language of NRS 38221 requires that if there is a pending judicial proceeding, as there was at the time that the stay motion was made, the request has to be filed in that court. I think the court's questions to Mr. Balducci were right on point. Why not just go into California and request a stay?
Well, now that I hear your causes of action, now I understand why they want arbitration so badly, because they want to get away from punitive damages on the fraud.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think this is perhaps, and I have only a minute left, and I'd really like the court to understand this. Any claim that the petitioners would somehow waive their jurisdictional objections in California by going in and making an arbitration, you know, motion or anything else is 100% false. And I laid this out for the court in our response to their request for emergency writ relief. We have a statute in California. It's Code of Civil Procedure 41810E. We use it all the time. It expressly says once a party has contested jurisdiction, which they did, then no act of any kind by that party, whatever it is, constitutes a waiver of the jurisdictional argument or a general appearance until the jurisdictional motion is resolved. They filed their jurisdictional objection a year ago. Once they filed that paper, that is an absolute 100% safe harbor. They can do whatever they want in California. They can make a motion to arbitrate. They can answer. They can file a demur. They can do anything, and it does not waive the jurisdictional arguments. I've explained this to counsel. I've explained this to the court. I've explained it to this court. That law is crystal clear. There's absolutely no doubt about it. I think the reason they haven't made the motion to arbitrate in California is they will lose that motion. The arbitration provision here does not apply to these clients, and the arbitration request that they made in the district court was as to only one of what is now 13 plaintiffs in California. I'm over my time. I'd be happy to answer any more questions that the court has.
I'm good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Balducci. What do you have to say about his reference to the California Code 1418E?
If the law was so clear, I would not have expended the time or money to take the California bar, because the frank reality of it is there is nothing clear about the case law concerning that particular statute. Otherwise, I wouldn't have done it. I had no reason to be in California with a bar license. This is the only case I have that's over there. That in itself tells us for how unclear it is, and I can certainly say it was not a cheap exam to take. Nor was it easy on time as well.
Isn't there anybody over at Murky and Arbuck that's got a California bar? Oh, hello.
Yeah.
So why did you have to take it? I'm
just... The reason being, well, this case goes back long, just background. I've been involved with these companies for a long time, and so that's why, is because I know the factual history. Let me just first address something really quick. In terms of their attempt to challenge 645B, Your Honor, you're 100% correct. This court... It's a writ petition, and it's only ordered briefing argument on the issue of the stay. Mm-hmm. Second, it doesn't really matter because the opposition to the motion to compel arbitration is not even in the record before this court. So it wasn't raised in the district court. You can't raise it now in terms of opposition to the stay. Second, with respect to the arbitration provision, as I've said and as we know, courts determine whether the arbitration provisions are enforceable. Arbitrators determine if the contract is enforceable. So first you go to arbitration, and the arbitrator can do with what they want with those documents. And just in terms of what they're talking about, those claims, everything is merged into that joint venture agreement that's at the heart of this case that canceled all those guarantees and everything. But we don't need to get there, because the only reason we're here today is on the issue of 38-221-67. With respect to the concept that I filed in the wrong court, 6 and 7 are more specific as to where you must file the motion compared to 5. 5 is broader. But regardless, that subsection 5 in sentence 2 says otherwise, as you can file under NRS 38.246. So it's telling you can do either way. But in NRS 38.246, it says the court which hears the initial motion must hear all subsequent motions. So we can't bring it over there. It has to be before the 8th Judicial District because they heard the initial motion to compel arbitration. And yes, I will concede that at this point, just the Farinas are compelled. However, we have a pending motion which requires the entry of a stay under subsection 6. Because subsection 6 deals with when you have a pending motion. Subsection 7 deals with when you have an order entered against a party. And because we have both here, we moved under both. And so you actually don't even need to deal with the order because we have the pending motion.
So we could be seeing you again is what you're telling us.
Yeah. Okay. That's absolutely correct. In terms of dealing with this arbitration provision that we have here, I mean, it is for quicker, more efficient resolution of disputes. There's no doubt about that. That's its purpose. It's not for us to be gallivanting among multiple forms and jurisdictions where they can try to file where they think they can put me in a weird spot or where they think they're going to have different sorts of damages. This is what was agreed to. This is what the joint venture agreement requires. There's a place to fight this fight, and it's at Jams here in Las Vegas. The courts already ordered it. We already have a motion pending on the same basis. I think we can generally expect what's probably going to derive from that. They chose not to challenge that order. You can't do an answer to writ. They didn't even raise those positions in response to the stay. They can't even do that here. It's not before the court. It's Carson Ready Mix. We all know that. I see I have a minute left. I don't want to just talk.
Who's your arbitrator at Jams?
You know, I wish I knew, but because
it won't be David Lee, I take it.
I imagine it would not be, but because they're not showing up, we haven't been appointed one. So we're still waiting. Anything else? With that being said, I'll just close with our request for relief, is that this court reverse the district court order, instruct the district court to stay any judicial proceedings that the Aspen parties before this court are utilizing and prosecuting against my clients. Thank you.
Thank you very much, both sides. Thank you for your the briefing that you've done and the argument. We appreciate it. Thank you so much. This matter stands submitted.